Well, good afternoon. I will mention first, many of you know this, but I don't think I actually said it so that everybody could hear it. I'm going to be able to go to Thailand again for the spring holy days, thanks to the generosity of some people who bought my ticket, since I couldn't afford to do it myself. And in fact, we got enough money where we can provide meals again for those who are keeping the feast in northern Thailand. Because I am able to go to Legacy and be there for the Passover, then Leon and Gloria and probably Aja, the translator, I don't know who else is going to go. He always takes the best translator. They will be going to Burma and then meet all the Burmese brethren will be able to come to that central location. I don't know where it's going to be, probably in Tongo. And for them, as well as in Thailand, I think I mentioned before, it's kind of like a Feast of Tabernacles. So we have service every day. We have, in my case, in Thailand, we'll probably do studies most of the evenings as well. The people are hungry. They want to hear the gospel. And you can't cover as much in a given sermon as you can when you're speaking to people in your own language. Over there, it all has to be translated. I was blessed. I was told that I would be given a couple of translators, and they were very inexperienced, and I wasn't going to be able to cover much, and I needed to get my notes there a month in advance, and this, that, and the other. And I said, oh, no, God, please, I don't want to have to. I'll do that if I have to, but can something else work out? So I contacted a couple of former students that are still in, well, one's Thai, the other's Burmese, but he still lives in Thailand. And I asked the one first if he would be able to translate, the same guy that translated for me last year. And he will be on a break from university, and he will come. He said he will be there for the holy days, and he would translate for me. So that's really good. He'll translate into the Korean language. So it'll be the same as before, or similar. I'll talk in English. I won't read the scriptures. The scriptures will be read in Burmese by students there. We don't translate the scripture. That's the tradition there. We don't translate scripture. We just read it from everybody's native Bible, their own language. So the scriptures will be read in Burmese, and what I say will be translated into Korean. There are going to be a few, there'll be probably two people there that understand English that I can think of, and two Burmese Kachin Burmese. Those are the people that are currently fighting the Burmese government. And currently, they've been doing it for 40 years, but there's still no real ceasefire. It's up in the northern part of Burma near China. And there are two Kachin, there's a Kachin couple there with a little baby, and or a toddler, I guess. They have enough English skills, apparently, that they'll be able to understand me if I guess, don't talk too fast and keep it simple. So that's the plan. I'm leaving March 20, so I'll be getting there late on the 21st, and I'll be leaving, coming back here the day after, or the evening. I'll leave the evening of the first holy, of the last holy day, and I'll be getting here actually the next morning. You get here the same day you leave, pretty much, but it takes you 2 days to get there. That's the way it works. So anyway, I'm very thankful to those that have helped make that possible, and looking forward to the trip again. It takes a long time to get there, so I take lots of books and read on the plane, and sleep and whatever else. Okay. For those of you who were here almost a month ago now, I began a series of sermons on women in New Testament times. What was it like to be a woman in New Testament times? And if you want to go hear that, if you didn't hear the first sermon, I'm not going to, you know, obviously go over everything. I will summarize briefly. And the point of the sermon is to try to understand how it was back then, and this is just a good thing in general principle, trying to understand how it was so that we don't imagine incorrectly. Sometimes it is correct, sometimes it's not, but we don't want to put our current realities back into a 2,000-year-old culture and say, well, it's like it is now. In some cases, it is like it is now. In some cases, it's not, and it's good to understand the difference. But understanding how it used to be or how it was when the Bible was written, in my opinion, is a good tool for helping to understand the Bible. You're understanding, you know, how it was when the words were written, and that should be helpful. So the series is looking into more details in the lives of women during the first century of the present era, specifically looking at people in the Roman Empire. Obviously, there are other parts of the world at the time, but the Bible was written in the Roman Empire. or the New Testament was written in the Roman Empire. So we'll look at Romans and Jews and God-fearers, people who were Gentiles but who followed the God of Israel to one extent or another, at least were favorable to them. We'll look at those women. A special focus is on the women in the area of Judah and Judea, and Galilee. And the purpose of this is so that when we have a better understanding of the culture at the time, that some of the scriptures will make more sense to us. We'll be able to immerse ourselves a little bit into their culture. First, we began talking about being born a daughter in the Roman Empire. And I will not belabor this point. If you didn't hear the first sermon, go listen to it. It was a bit of a downer because actually what happened is that the father in a licit marriage, that is one who was a Roman citizen, the father made the decision as to whether or not a child was going to live. And if you were a girl, your chances of living weren't as great as if you were a boy for obvious reasons of work and all those kinds of things. Plus, it seems that men were just more valued in the culture. That was a Roman custom. That was not a Jewish custom. To the Jews, children were, the arrows in the quiver and so forth, and all children lived. And in fact, Jews at times would rescue, or Christians would rescue, some of the children who had been exposed. That's the term, exposed, when you didn't let a child live. They didn't actually kill the child, but they would just let it die. But a lot of times those children were rescued, sometimes raised as slaves. I'm not going to talk about slavery today. That will be I'll be at least one more sermon. A lot of women in the Roman Empire were slaves. That we'll talk about slavery because it was different then than what we may think it was. I did mention also that the idea of infanticide was common in the ancient world, but it was not an Egyptian custom. So to me, that was interesting. God, for whatever his reasons, he called his people out of Egypt. He led the people into Egypt, and he called them back out of Egypt. So the culture that they assimilated, now a lot of it was, a lot of the culture of Egypt was bad, but that was one thing that was good. They valued their children. In short, daughters were not as desired as sons, but in the Jewish culture, the children were all valued. Now, having said that, being born was one thing. Living past your childhood was another thing. Infant mortality was very high. It was just the way, it was high in the world until the past couple hundred years. So as a child, you didn't necessarily make it. Mothers didn't oftentimes make it through the childbirth process. And I don't know if I mentioned it, but it may be in part of today's sermon that actually in Roman culture, the relationship with children was more important or more valued when it was the relationship between you and your adult children, interestingly enough. I don't know why that is. I didn't see any opinions on that other than just that, you're attached to every child you had, obviously, but a lot of children didn't make it. It was just the nature of it, the nature of life then. It was much harsher, obviously. Then we talked about inheritance rights a little bit, and I was surprised actually by some of the laws. Women were they could inherit in a similar way to men. They had the ability to have their own independent economic wealth, power at times. Sometimes by law, they had control over resources that came to them by their family. Also, there were situations where the father retained control of his daughter, even after she got married, of her wealth. She had it to use, her husband could use it, but it remained the property of the family from where it came. So there were a lot of laws in the Roman Empire and in the late Roman Republic, which would be the time of the, right before the New Testament, that impacted the way finances were handled. And in some ways, it wasn't as different from today as we might think. Some of the laws are very similar to what we would have now. We looked at some scriptures in the Gospels and also in the book of Acts that showed that at times women were at least hinted, I think it doesn't prove it, but it hinted that women were very important benefactors of Jesus' ministry and Paul's ministry. And how could they do that if they didn't have control of a certain amount of family wealth? So they were called leading women, prominent women. We went through those scriptures, and you could get the first sermon if you didn't hear it. The bottom line, I think, is that women in Roman society, and also in Jewish society to a lesser extent, had the same rights to control their own destiny and use of family resources as men. They weren't totally in a situation. You might think, oh, it's a long time ago and it was a male-dominated society. Well, that's true. And the women had no rights. That's not true. By law, the women did have rights, and they did have a certain amount of economic control over their own future. And as we saw from those scriptures in Acts and in the Gospels, the church, the early church, benefited from that reality, because sometimes it was women who were financing the aspects of the work. Then we talked, the last subject we got on last time was marriage, and we didn't actually finish that. But there are many sources, and they oftentimes focus or write about the ideal marriage, you know, the Betty Crocker housewife type of thing that we might have in America. When you read that, and I mentioned that I've one of the sources I'm using, the main source I'm using here, is Women in the World of the Earliest Christians by Lynn Coick. And this is a resource that looks at the firsthand evidence. It's looking at the iconography, however you say that word, looking at the literary evidence, looking at actual works, things that have survived down to this time that it can look at. And in doing that, there's a caution. Because you don't know whether just the fact that one person's writings survive, if that person, on a particular topic, you can't assume that that person represents reality, number one, or that what that person wrote is even the most popular opinion about that particular subject, or the one opinion that's most widely shared. Somebody could have an axe to grind, and it could have been a nutcase and wrote, you know. So what helps is that in some cases, men like Juvenal or Livy or Pliny or whatever, these people, there's a lot of their writing that's preserved, and we can get a pretty good idea of where they were coming from and what axes they were grinding. And people like Lynn Coick and other historians can analyze what they write and try to draw the reality that was on the ground out from their writings. But also we have carvings, we have funerary inscriptions, we have tombstones, we have all this kind of stuff that gives evidence. You say, what's evidence on a tombstone? Sometimes it would identify the occupation of the person who's in the tomb. And if that person was a woman, and you find out, oh, this woman was a this or that, you realize that women, and we'll talk about that today, they weren't necessarily just home all the time, they had jobs. And it did, they did things. So we actually have firsthand evidence. We're not just guessing. You got a tombstone. You look at it, you know, and you find out certain things. Or there are writings that exist that are 2,000 years old. Marriage is a contract. It's a contract between families. And we discussed, and I didn't go into it in a lot of detail, but the reality was that the records or what the laws were concerned with was the finances. It was, whose money's going into this marriage? This money coming from her father, this money coming from this guy, this family. And what happens when somebody dies? And what happens when somebody gets divorced? What happens? And there were laws that regulated all this. And that's what we have as the resource for understanding the way marriage was. It seems that you were married because you decided to live together, and you said you're married. You didn't go to the preacher, you know, go to the chapel and go to the preacher and have a ceremony. You didn't have to do that. It doesn't mean they couldn't do that or whatever, but that wasn't the way. You know, what we consider marriage, again, we don't want to put it back on their time. They just, the families got together, they decided this was going to be a match, and you were married. And the legality was the arrangement of the finances. What happens to the dowry? What happens to the I think we mentioned about the Jewish bride, the bride price, and some of those things, or maybe not. Maybe I didn't get to that. No, we'll talk. I think we'll talk about that a little bit today. But much of the surviving evidence about marriage law, anyway, is in the form of dowry contracts, which we still have record of. And also, it seems from the evidence that we have that there was no major difference between the way, in the time of the New Testament, between the way the Jews handled marriage contracts or dowry contracts or whatever, and the way the Gentiles did. Doesn't seem to be much of a difference. And we have all these, I won't get into that now because I want to talk about that later. I'll talk about some of the Jewish customs that we talk about now and how they correspond to the reality back then. The husband is seen in the writings as being the one responsible for managing the household. But what we find is that women, or wives in particular, had tremendous responsibility. And we looked at the scriptures in Timothy, where it uses the word manage in the King James, and other translations use other words, but that where women were in control of the household. In fact, I didn't look it up last. I saw it this week when I was looking back through this, that one ancient source refers to the woman as the head of the household. Now, what does that mean? You know, we talk about head of household today. We fill out our taxes. It generally means the main wage earner. Could be male, female. I guess it doesn't matter. But the idea was that oftentimes the husband could be in the military. He could be off serving somewhere else. He could be in politics. He could have a very public life and be involved out in the community, be involved in his town, village, or whatever. And the actual day-to-day functioning of the household fell to the wife. And it didn't mean she did all the cooking and cleaning. It probably, in a lot of cases, it meant the slaves or the freedmen that worked for them. You know, there was a household. It wasn't just the husband and wife and a few kids. It was the husband and wife, a few kids, some freed people, and also some slaves. And they were all members of the household. And as often as not, it seems from what we read, and even consistent with Scripture, the New Testament, that it was the woman in the house who ran all that and kept tabs on it. And she didn't necessarily do everything. She had to manage the slaves. Okay, so that seemed to be, you know, like we say, well, you know, women kind of, even in our society, that's the ideal. You know, we have this picture, the Betty Crocker mom, and she's running the household. It meant a little bit more in those days. It meant you handled all the home employees, if you want to call them that, or slaves. It was a much bigger responsibility in some ways, as well as having primary responsibility for the children, although slaves, if you were rich enough, the slaves had a role there. Okay. Where I ended was talking about Augustus, who was the Roman emperor after Julius Caesar, and at the time that most of the early part of our New Testament time here, there were a lot of laws that we still have a record of that were passed during his administration. We're not sure why there were so many, but they seemed to encourage family life and having children. And this was the Roman ideal. You got married, you had a studious, industrious wife who made many fine young Roman citizens and trained them well and brought them up and so forth. Producing children was expected. It was expected in a Jewish home. It was expected, or at least encouraged, and encouraged literally by law, to have many children in a Roman marriage. I may have mentioned, if I didn't, I'll mention it now, that these laws were structured so that sometimes, let's say, a slave woman could become a freed woman after having four live births. A live birth meant child lasted, at least lived for a certain number of days. I forget what it was, maybe a couple of weeks. And there were certain laws that, there were restrictive laws on women. I think I mentioned, in terms of how they could handle their affairs, I think I probably mentioned that you were oftentimes, as a woman, would be, in a legal sense, represented by her husband or her father, or a brother, a male, some male. If you had to go to court, you couldn't speak for yourself. Your brother, you know, whoever this person was, would speak for you. You didn't usually go to the local government. You could go down to City Hall, plead your case. You had a male do it for you. That's just the way the culture was. But in certain of those restrictions where this particular male individual had a certain amount of control over your life or over your finances, when you had three live births, that under these Augustus's laws, when you had three live births, those restrictions were removed. You still had to be represented in court by this man, but the restriction over your control of your inheritance was removed when you had three live births. So what's the reason? It sounds to me just like currently we have, I think, laws on the books, maybe in Japan, some of you might know that better, but there are certain areas where the birth rate is so low, they're worried about the ability of society to pay for the all the benefits that the older people are supposed to get, and so now they're encouraging more children. Russia's one. So you can write laws in such a way, even in America we have laws like that, where you get tax deductions for your children, so it encourages the birth of more children. Well, that's at least a 2,000-year-old phenomenon. Augustus passed laws just like that. Well, the Roman Senate did when Augustus asked them to. That's the way it worked, I think, in the empire. Now, Jewish marriage was not always the same as Roman, but there were obviously similarities because they lived in the Roman world. Jews, in general, were not citizens. Remember, I made a point before, and I'll use it, I'll make it again for those that weren't here. There are the term licit and illicit. We come to view that as being legal and not legal, and illegal. Well, that is what it meant. Even then, I guess it's probably a Latin, Jim would know, it's probably a Latin word. But illicit marriage, one that was licit, was a marriage between citizens. That's all it meant. And if you were a Roman citizen and your mate was a Roman citizen, you were bound to, or the laws of the Roman Empire, you were subject to those laws. That was a licit marriage. If you were Jewish in Galilee, typical Jew in Galilee, you were not a Roman citizen. And therefore, those laws didn't apply to you. Now, they might have been the environment, and they may have been the precedent for you and so forth. But nobody could say, well, you weren't obeying this law, therefore we're gonna punish you, because it didn't apply to you. Your marriage, if you were Jewish, was typically an illicit marriage. It doesn't mean it was a wrong marriage or illegal. It just means it wasn't subject to the Roman laws because you were not a citizen. The typical Jew that we read about in the New Testament was not a Roman citizen. Paul was not normal. His city where he was from, Tarsus, was given Roman citizenship, as the whole city was, so he was a Roman citizen. But that wasn't the case for the Jews in Judea and Galilee. The Jews preferred, it wasn't a law, but they preferred to marry themselves. In other words, marriage between Jews. That was not a typical Roman thing where you married within your own clan, but the Jews, you know, and they've done that throughout history, have married themselves. That's not even, as far as I know, it's not in the Torah. The priests had to marry, there were restrictions on who they could marry, of the Aaronic line. But other than that, I don't think there were restrictions. But they tended to marry among themselves. Also, in Jewish culture, and here's something that I didn't know before, and I've said things incorrectly, we'll get into that. Polygyny, having more than one husband, or more than one wife, I guess it's more commonly how it happens, was allowed. I'm not saying the Bible allowed that necessarily, but it was part of the culture. And it was against the law, the Roman law. But since the Roman law did not apply to the Jewish citizenry, the Jewish populace, they could do it. And there is evidence, we have certain contracts between, where people are married to more than one person. So we know it, the historians know that it happened. It may not have been universally approved. It may not have been popular or encouraged, but it did occur. We know it occurred. More than one wife at a time. Now, when we read, if you go to the qualifications for those that were going to be bishops in the church, and it says, or even deacons, I think, it says, husband of one wife. And I've always said to myself, and I probably said it out loud in sermons, is, well, what does that mean? And I've said, I know I've read this, and so I thought this was true, and I may have said it, so I want to correct it now. I have read in the past that, look, in Rome, it was illegal to have more than one wife, so this can't be referring to having two wives. Now, what I've learned in preparing these messages is that, yes, that's true. In Rome, it was illegal to have more than one wife if you were a citizen of Rome. The Jews, in general, were not citizens of Rome. They could have as many wives as they wanted. Okay? It wasn't against the law for a Jew who was not a Roman citizen to have more than one wife. So it's possible, anyway, that Paul could have been just simply writing, can't have more than one wife. There are other ways of looking at that. That could be the case too. But at least it's possible. You can't use that argument, or I don't think it's proper to use the argument, look, it was illegal in the Roman Empire to have more than one wife. That only applied to citizens. Didn't apply to the Jews. So that's Titus 1 verse 6, 1 Timothy 3 verse 12 are two areas where that's used. I just want to throw that out there. We can't use that. If you've heard that argument in the past, I don't think it's valid based on what I've learned. I'm not saying the Bible encourages that, but it doesn't seem to prohibit it as clearly as we may want it to in our current society and way of looking at things. And that is a problem if you ever talk to anybody who works in any way, you know, in the mission field, as it's often called, in Africa, where it is common to have more than one wife, and you know, you're trying to say, well, that's not the way we like to see it. And I'm not saying how we explain it, because I've never had to do that, but I've talked to people who have, and they say, well, you know, Jacob had four, Abraham had three or four, you know, whatever. You can go on and on. The patriarchs had more than one wife. And the kings of Israel had more than one wife, and so forth, and so on. So it's a difficult thing to argue if you want to make the case from, look, the Bible says thus. What if you want to thus saith? It's hard to find that thus saith. You read the whole book, as I've encouraged you in another sermon. Read the whole book, put it together, and see from the beginning it was not so. See how God has created and established things. I think the principle's clear, but if you're looking for, you know, chapter and verse that says don't do this or do this, sometimes it's difficult to find, and those Africans are quick to point it out, especially the ones that already have more than one wife. So if you ever get the opportunity to go to Africa and teach them, and you tell me how it goes, because that will come up in some of the cultures there. Marriage law in the Roman Republic. Now, Roman Republic refers to the time before Julius Caesar, when the Senate made the laws and there was no emperor. And so that would be in the century before the New Testament was written. And there was this, in Latin, I guess it's called sine manu, the hand of the father had control, or some male relative, that's what I was telling you about before. That when the woman got married, the father did not lose control of the wife. He still had control of his daughter. He still had control. she brought a dowry, money from the family, into the marriage. And if the husband dies, or if there's a divorce or whatever, and she has to leave the marriage, that dowry goes with her. It doesn't stay with the husband or with the husband's family. That was one of the laws. And that was in the Roman Republic before Augustus's laws. Now, that what does that accomplish? One thing it accomplishes is if you happen to marry, you know, maybe someone you're equal, or maybe someone with a little more money than your family, it was an encouragement to be a good husband. Because if you're not a good husband, she could be out of here and she takes the money with her. You know? So in that sense, it could be good, and we're talking, this is from the perspective of women, this was a law that helped protect the women and protect their status in society. So that was a good thing, I think. The dowry it doesn't mean they brought money all the time. A lot of times a dowry was something that was income producing. For instance, you had a certain amount of property. You had these olive groves, and you might give a grove or two to your daughter. And so, you know, it didn't mean that she had to work the groves necessarily. It might come with slaves, come with whatever, but it's income producing. And then you give that to your daughter, and she has control of it in a way. I mean, you still do. And it helps provide income for the new family, your daughter and your son-in-law and so forth. Marriage breaks up for whatever reason, or the husband dies. That those olive groves remain with the woman and with you, your family, so that they don't leave they don't leave the family. And that's, in a way, when you look at the Torah and how it was done then, it kind of follows that principle. It's a good principle. It keeps wealth in the family to a certain, tied to the land anyway, to in the family. In a licit marriage, and I hinted at this when we talked about exposure, in a licit marriage, a marriage that's controlled by Roman law because it's between Roman citizens, the father had control of the children. The children got the status of the father. In an illicit marriage, the children got the status of the mother. And we still have I don't know if it's tied to that or not, but we still have that custom among the Jews. You're Jewish if your mother's Jewish, right? Not if your father's Jewish. You're Jewish if your mother's Jewish. Well, that's the way the law was back then. The mother had control or the say of the children, and the children followed the status of the mother. When I say status, slave, freedman, citizen, so on. You know, children are born. What happens if you have a situation where I'm not going to answer all these questions, but you get into, well, what if you have a slave married to a freed person, or a citizen married to a non-citizen? Well, they had laws to control all that. And sometimes the children followed the status of the father, sometimes they followed the status of the mother, and that mattered, because whether you were a citizen or not matters. I go to Thailand, right? The Hill tribe people that Legacy focuses on educating, the ones that are Thai, they're not citizens, not most of them. They're not citizens. Citizenship is something you have to kind of buy or beg or borrow or steal. One fellow that I taught one year when I was there, Jaipur, and he changed his name, his family sold, they had orange groves, and sold some property to get the money to buy him citizenship. So we take it for granted. You're born here and you're a citizen. Not so in Thailand, not so necessarily in Rome. Depending on your status, you either took your mother's status or your father's status. So as I mentioned, the legal document when it came to marriage was the dowry. And in other ways, the government was not involved. You didn't have to prove this or prove that or divorce. You know, it wasn't like the government, like our government's involved here, because there are certain benefits that come to those that are married, you know, and we argue about that, whether your partners can get the benefits or whatever. Well, in Rome, for the most part, the government didn't treat you any differently whether you're married or not. So the laws had to do with the money, the dowry, the economic part of the marriage, not whether or not you were married or weren't married. So if you were, let's say again, the typical Jewish resident of the Galilee or of Judea, and you were married, and the Roman government didn't care one way or the other, whether you were married, not married, said you were married, it didn't really matter. You didn't have a quote-unquote legal marriage. You had whatever the custom of your culture decided. So that's different than today. And we think, oh, marriage means you walk down the aisle, you wear a different color dress, and you have bridesmaids, and you have a preacher, and you have this, and you have that. And that's a custom that's been something in the last 2,000 years. It wasn't the custom then. It's it's a custom of the Christian church. Okay, and that doesn't make it a bad custom or a good custom. It just recognizes it's not their custom in the times of the Bible. They didn't meet at the chapel and have the preacher marry him. You didn't have to. If you were Jewish, you didn't have to go get the priest to have a marriage. You know, it's different now than it was then. So we don't want to put our current society, even our Jewish customs now, back onto the situation 2,000 years ago. Because of the high mortality rates, people died of disease, people died in war, people died in childbirth. There were all kinds of reasons. People died in occupational type injuries, because of injuries. People died at a much higher rate and much earlier in life than they do now. Because of that, there was lots of divorce, death, remarriage, people getting married second and third times. Why? Because they outlived their first husband or their first wife and their second wife or their third. It was very, very common, much more common then than now, because of the high mortality rates. So there are a lot of records. When you say looking at the records, there are a lot of records about this, because it was a different world, and people typically had more than one marriage. To have something like Phil's parents, where they live a long life and they're married for many, many years, that was extremely rare. It was rare for anybody to live a long time, let alone two people that happen to be married to both live a long time, in order to celebrate those 60-year anniversaries and the wonderful things that are possible today. It just didn't happen then. For the most part, it just did not happen. Let's talk about the dowry now with respect to Jewish customs. And I'm going to also lead into some other things from here. Excuse me. In early history, when you look in the Old Testament, you had the idea of a bride price. A bride price. And this is where the money went from the husband to the bride's family. All right? That's different than a dowry, right? It's the same as a dowry, sorry. But it changes along the lines. But the money goes to the bride's family, the bride price. And no, it's not that it is different than a dowry. In Exodus 22, I will go back there. Exodus 22, verse 16. I confused myself, sorry. Yeah, dowry is different than a bride price. And, you know, it's easy to, at least for me, to confuse the two sometimes. But it changed historically over time. In Exodus 22, verse 16, it says, don't afflict any widow or fatherless child. Nope, that's not what I want. 16. If a man entice a maid that's not betrothed and lie with her, he will surely endow her to be his wife. You have to pay a price. If her father refuses, he'd pay the money anyway. All right, there was money that was paid. And I won't turn there, but you can write down 1 Samuel 18, verses 23 to 26, where Saul's daughter Michal liked David. David liked Michal okay, but came from a poor family, didn't have the money to pay the king, the kind of money that he should pay for a bride price to marry the king's daughter. And Saul came up with a scheme that he was hoping that David would just be killed. And I won't go into the details. You can look that up if you don't remember of what it was that he had to pay as a bride price. But the idea was that the bride price was something you paid to the bride's family. You didn't get that back. You know, your marriage didn't last or whatever. You didn't get that out. You just paid it. It was viewed, at least the way we view it now when we talk about it, it was viewed as like the family loses the services of the daughter. Therefore, you're going to pay for that. You're going to pay for the fact that she's coming to serve you and work with you. So that was the economic idea. In Hellenistic times, the times after Alexander, it shifted to the dowry. And in Jewish culture, we talk about bride price. Sometimes we talk about Jewish marriage customs, and it's interesting. You tie it in with the holy days. I've spoken about that. You've probably heard about that from others as well. It's very interesting. But it turns out that sometimes all of those things weren't true at any one time. Yes, there was a bride price, but by the time that some of the other customs were true, they weren't doing a bride price anymore. They were doing a dowry just the way the Romans were, and the money was going in the other direction. So the evidence strongly suggests that this switch happened around the time when we call it the Hellenistic times, the times after Alexander the Great, when the area there where Israel is was in between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids and, you know, those Greek empires that were constantly fighting each other, and Jerusalem was caught in the middle. And that was a time of intense pressure and intense change, very much change in the Jewish society in the region. So when we read about a marriage contract, which that Hebrew word is ketubah or something like that, it seems to be a later invention. It seems to be something that came later in time. And we might project it back onto the times of before the New Testament or right in New Testament times, but it doesn't seem to be something that was current then. It seems from the records that we have, and she's got, you know, the firsthand looked at them, and other scholars have, it seems from the records that we have that in the time of the New Testament, they were using the same dowry system that the Romans used, not a marriage contract or the ketubah in the same sense. So we just, putting those facts together, and this is an admonition to me, because I've looked at some of these customs, and you put it all, it seems so beautiful. Oh, you put this together with this and this and this, and it all works together beautifully. And then it looks like historically that sometimes all of those things weren't in play at the same time. That doesn't mean we can't learn from them and use them to paint a pretty picture in a way, but let's not think that this is just the way Jews always got married and all the way they always handled everything, because those customs change throughout time, just as, you know, has always happened throughout history. Now, Jewish customs regarding divorce, that's another issue. That's another issue, and it wasn't the same as the Romans. In Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, is that famous scripture that was debated, still debated today, about divorce. It says, when a man has taken a wife, Deuteronomy 24:1, and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, reading from the King James, Then let him write her a bill of divorcement and give it to her hand and send her out of his house. So it's saying, hey, you can have a divorce. In Matthew 19, and we ought to turn there. Matthew 19, and again, the purpose of going through these things is to try to shed some light on these verses in Scripture that have to do with women, so we can understand them a little better. Matthew 19, verse 3. The Pharisees came to Jesus, tempting him, and saying, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? Why is it that they were tempting him? Why would they say that? Why is this written this way in Matthew? Why did Matthew say they were tempting him? Well, it was a test of some sort, right? It was a trap. And anybody familiar with what the trap was, what the discussion was? You had two famous rabbis in the century before this, one called Hillel, one called Shammai, who had their own followings in the time of Jesus. And although they agreed on most everything, on certain details they differed. And now they had the house or the school of Shammai, the people who followed his teachings and the people who followed Hillel's teaching. And one was typically, not all the time though, more conservative than the other. And one of those schools, they disputed on a lot of things, but one of the disputes had to do with when and how you can be divorced. And the house of Shammai, Bet Shammai, or however you say that, said it's only for fornication, only for some kind of sexual sin. And Hillel's group said, basically, if you burn the soup, literally said that, you know, you burn the soup, because it says that they find anything. And so this was the argument. Over what you can get divorced. Well, these people were trying to get Jesus, and you know, you can't win that, right? You're gonna have to side with one or the other. That's what they think. And so then, you know, you can't win the argument. And so they sucked him in, or they tried to suck him in. That's the idea, but they didn't. And of course, his answer was very clever, because they said, well, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for any cause, any reason? Burning the toast, burning the soup. And he said, well, haven't you read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female, and for this cause shall a man leave father and mother? And they're not two, but one flesh. So whatever God has joined together, let not man put asunder. Well, he kind of leans toward the Shammai side of the argument, but he also didn't answer their question directly, which he was very good at, according to the gospel writers. They'd try to trap him in a question, and he wouldn't answer. He knew what the traps were, and apparently this one was pretty obvious. I mean, anybody would have known what this trap was, and he refused to be caught in it. And notice, then they said, well, then why did Moses give him a commandment? And they said, because of the hardness of your hearts in verse 8, and said, talked about adultery in verse 9. Then his disciples said, boy, if that's the way it is, it'd be good not to marry. Whoa, that's too strict. I look at that, and I'm not sure that I understand everything about that, but I think it's really interesting that, you know, Jesus said in so many words that marriage is supposed to be. The ideal here is that it's supposed to be for life. It's supposed to make it work if you possibly can. You can't just, you know, get rid of your wife because she burns the toast. And then the answer is, well, it isn't worth getting married then. We're not worth taking a risk. It seemed odd. It just seems odd. But anyway, that was a popular discussion. It's the kind of things when people sit around and, you know, what do we talk about in America? You know, we got our people that listen to Rush Limbaugh and our people that listen to some liberal or whatever, and then we're going to discuss politics. Well, back then they discussed interpretations of the law, or perhaps they discussed different revolutionary ideas having to do with between the Jews and the Roman Empire. But this was a typical kind of a conversation around the table after dinner, and Jesus wasn't going to get caught. Okay, I'll leave marriage and let's talk about motherhood a little bit. Motherhood. I already have talked about motherhood to one extent or another. To whom does the child belong in the sense of who has the right of say-so, what the child will do, what its course will be, what status the child gets? Well, in a licit marriage, a marriage between Roman citizens, it's the father. In an illicit marriage, it's the mother. In a slave, if your father or mother is a slave, it's the slave owner that gets to decide your fate. Right, your parents don't really have much say. depending on, you know, the relationship between the slave and the owner. It can get very complicated because sometimes slaves were freed. Sometimes one slave, you know, the father might have become a freedman, but the mother was still a slave. Sometimes they worked for different people. It is very complicated, and the laws controlling and governing all that were equally complicated. It was one of those things in society that, kind of like our tax code today, it just got more and more complicated as the possibilities expanded. I mentioned that under Augustus, the women gained some rights. Let me just read some quote here from Lynn Kohick's book. During Augustus's rule, he established laws that gave mothers freedom from a guardian. Remember, he said they had to be represented by a male, and that still is the case in some cases here. But specifically, the Lex Julia and the Lex Poppaea allowed free women. These were two of his laws. Allowed free women who had three live births and freed women that had been slaves were freed, with four live births to become independent of their guardians and patron, or patron, depending on whether they had been a slave or not. This status allowed women to conduct business and legal affairs without a tutor. A child must live 8 or 9 days to be counted as a live birth, and the freed woman's children must have all been born after she gained her freedom. The more children a couple had, the greater the inheritance possibilities of the wife or husband. If a couple had no children, the surviving spouse could inherit only 10% of the other's estate. So your inheritance rights kind of depended on how many children you had. So that's an interesting twist. It's not the way it is now, of course. Well, I shouldn't say it's not the way. You know, we child support has to do with how many children you have. So I guess there is a connection there. But with each child born, the wife or husband could claim a further tenth of the other's estate, so long as the child lived long enough to be named, about 8 days. If the husband or wife had children from a previous marriage, they also counted toward the final percentage. The rules of inheritance were complex, and an individual's circumstances could shift quickly with a spouse's death and subsequent remarriage to someone else, and that someone else could even have children. So it did get complicated from time to time. Childbirth, as I mentioned, was a dangerous affair. Many women died in childbirth. I'm continuing to quote here. Children died in infancy or early childhood. In a tender testimony to his wife, Titus Julius Fortunatus, a Roman centurion, speaks of her incomparable nature and exceptional devotion to him. They married when she was 11 years old. Their marriage lasted 16 years until her death at age 27. During that time, she had 6 pregnancies, but only one child lived to adulthood. This harsh statistic unfortunately reflects the norm. Even in the upper echelons of society, infant mortality and the mother's death in childbirth were frighteningly high. Death is no respecter of wealth or status. Julius Caesar's daughter Julia died while giving birth in 54 BC. Rich and poor suffered alike, as evidenced by Cornelia, the mother of Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus. She had 12 live births, only 3, including those 2 brothers, survived into adulthood. Now, these are records that we have of specific families. So you can see that the mortality rate was so high, it changed everything. When we look back at the New Testament or even the Old Testament, whatever, we look back at these times, I think we need to remember that. You know, the idea that we live long and productive lives, that's a modern phenomenon. It was not the case. Even just several hundred years ago, it was not the case. But definitely was not the case back then. As I said, Roman society put more emphasis on relationships with grown children than minors. That's a huge difference from today. I mean, you know how it is. You have a baby, and all of a sudden you got a zillion toys, and you got all this paraphernalia that goes with it. It's a lot of attention. And I'm not saying that's bad. My point is that we celebrate and love the little ones, and so we should. I'm not complaining about that. But it wasn't quite the same back then, because it almost seems like it was a fatalistic approach. Like, well, you have to live. And it's sad, but that's just the way life was. That's the reality. Now we assume that they're going to live, and that's great. In Hellenistic societies, the education of women was praised. They were, at least in the writings that survive, we see, so-and-so was educated. That was a good thing. What's interesting, though, is why it was viewed as a good thing. Can anybody imagine What do you think? Why would somebody think back in these times, 2,000 years ago, or even before, in the time of the New Testament, in those couple hundred years, the Hellenistic times, when you read about education of a woman, why would that be a good thing? Anybody think ahead of me here? Not that I'm thinking. I read it.
Because they were taking care of the household.
Because they what?
They were taking care of the household.
I think that's part of it, but that's part of it. You're we're on the right track.
It probably has something to do with money. Maybe not. I don't know.
I'm not sure about that. The idea, I think, from the reading I did, it seemed that the reason why this education was a good thing is because they could pass that knowledge on to their sons. It was for a temporary good. The only good you were as an educated woman, this is in general. Now, there were some, I'm not going to get into all that, there were a few women philosophers, there were women, prominent women that were educated, and they did well in their own right. But in general, the idea was, it's good for you to be educated because you can pass that on to your sons. And we see that in the Bible, remember? Did I write it down? 1 Timothy. It's in Timothy. Well, it doesn't literally talk about education necessarily. Anybody know where this is? Maybe, I don't think I wrote it down. I'm not going to find it. Anyway, where Paul talks about Timothy, and he says, well, you learn from your mother and your grandmother, right? I'm sure Timothy's mother and grandmother were fine people, and they learned Torah. They learned the Bible. Why was that a good thing? Because they passed it on to the son and the grandson. I'm not saying that Paul didn't think it was good for their own sake, but he was pointing it out because it passed down to Timothy. Yes.
2 Timothy 1:5.
2 Timothy. Oh, that's why I was in the wrong one. Okay. Thank you. Not that I have to read it, but it's, I think it's interesting. I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in you, which dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, or Eunice, probably Eunice, and I am persuaded that in you also. Remember, his father was Greek. His father was a Gentile. Mother was Jewish. He follows the status of his mother. So when Paul went to use him, what did he have to do back in the book of Acts? He wanted to use Timothy to help in the ministry. What did he do with Timothy? Anybody remember? What did he have to do? He had to get him circumcised. Timothy had to be circumcised because he was Jewish. His mother was Jewish, and he hadn't been circumcised because his dad didn't care, I guess. But in order to serve in the Jewish community, having a Jewish mother, he had to be circumcised to be effective. And then later on, Paul worked with Titus, who was a Gentile. I guess he had to be Gentile. Where was he from? Crete or Crete, I think. Anyway, they wanted him to be circumcised, and he said, no way. So, Paul wasn't, you can't put Paul in a buttonhole here, say he was always this way or that way. It depended on the circumstances. You don't compel Titus to be circumcised, but Timothy was, and it was a different reason. Okay. Now, I read about childbirth being dangerous. I do want to read a scripture. I'm not going to be able to give you the, I can't tell you what this means. Maybe you can tell me what it means. 1 Timothy 2. Nope. 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy 2:15. All right, he's talking about Adam and Eve and talking about not usurping authority. And I'm not going to discuss all that today. Might get into that next time. Adam was not deceived, verse 14. The woman being deceived was in the transgression. Verse 15. Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety. What does that mean? Well, I don't know. And you can read all the commentaries that you want, and they don't know either. I mean, they have their opinions, but it's just one of those verses that we just, I don't know. I don't know what it means. What does it mean? She'll be saved in childbearing. Well, I still don't know. But after reading about what it was like to have children and what your chances of survival were and so forth, this, at least, if nothing else, is a very encouraging verse to say, look, God will be with you in what, in our day, back then, you know, is a quite dangerous undertaking. That God will be with you. So I never read it in those terms. I've always read that verse and wondered what it meant. I still wonder what it means. But at least now I can think, well, if you were on the receiving end of that as a woman, that would be encouraging. Because you wanted to have children, and so you did, but you knew there was a chance you wouldn't make it through. That was just part of the reality. So here Paul says something encouraging, that God's going to look after you. Maybe that sheds a little light on it, maybe not. I don't know. Just thought it was interesting. As far as the value of education for a woman, Eurydice, who was the grandmother of Alexander the Great, we have the evidence still, I mean the writing, where she was complimented for passing on the the values that she had to her children. I don't know if her child was Philip of Macedon and then Alexander the Great. I did have 2 Timothy 1:5 written down here, just didn't see it. The point is that it seems from the existing records that we have that education for a woman was okay, but not for her own, it wasn't for her own sake necessarily. It was for the purpose of passing it on to her children, and more specifically, passing it on to her sons. Okay, that would be the value, or the main value, or the most important value of an education for a woman at this time. not for her own sake, to be educated. But there were women, many women who were educated. There were many Jewish women. Even though there's this famous saying about, I didn't write it down. Maybe some of you know it. It's something that women shouldn't learn Torah because it's a waste of time. Or I don't know how it's phrased, but some really negative thing about letting women learn Torah. But in spite of that, people did. Women did learn Torah, just like we read about Timothy's mother and grandmother, and there were others. And there were some who kind of devoted themselves to that, and there were prophetesses, and that's not part of today's message. There were women who were involved in a very important ways and very dedicated ways. Okay, I was talking about motherhood still. Let's talk about Mary, the mother of Jesus, and I've talked about her before, and I want to address some things I've said, and that maybe I didn't have... I don't know that I said I had things right before, but I certainly preached with a certain conviction that certain approaches were correct, and now I'm not so sure. I'll tell you why. Engagements in the Roman Empire were not common. You didn't have to get engaged. You just got married. But among the Jews, we've talked about this before, the engagement, betrothal, whatever you want to call it, was as binding as marriage. And if you wanted to break a betrothal, you had to get a divorce. We are familiar with that in Matthew. If you want to go back to the book of Matthew, chapter 1. And you remember when Joseph found out that Mary was pregnant, he wanted to get a bill of divorcement. And he was going to do it quietly so it wouldn't be a big public embarrassment for Mary. Verse 19, when Joseph, her husband, being a just man, not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privately. But while he thought on those things, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, you son of David, don't fear to take Mary your wife, for that which is within her is conceived of the Holy Spirit. She will bring forth a son, talks about it'll be Jesus, he'll save his people from her sins. And Joseph, in verse 24, raised from sleep, did as the angel of the Lord bidden him, and took Mary as his wife. Okay, so we have the story. We know that Joseph was going to put her away. That means he was going to get a bill of divorcement. You had to do that because the engagement was as binding as the marriage. I'm not even sure what the marriage was. You had a big party. Everybody came over. You had the bridesmaids, you had the groomsmen, and you had the, as I've mentioned before, you know, we have a bride in Israel, whatever or marriage in Israel, whatever that phrase is, which meant they consummated the marriage. But it was consummated not because some preacher said, I pronounce you husband and wife. It was consummated because they shared the bedroom. That's how it happened. Mary was probably, as I've said before, very, very young, you know, a teenager, and Joseph was probably older, might not have even been his first marriage. That would not have been atypical. That would have been something that's fairly normal. But it was the question is, and here's what I may have been wrong about. Was it a big deal to the outside world that Mary was pregnant. It was a big deal to Joseph because, we read here that he knew it wasn't his. So what was his problem? His problem was he's obviously suspected what? Another man. He suspected adultery. And that was even Shammai agreed that that's good enough reason for divorce, adultery. Okay? And so he was going to do that, although he was going to do it quietly. He assumed adultery. Later on, again, I can't prove this, that applied, I can't prove it applied at this time, but I did find out that later on in rabbinic Judaism, several hundred years later than this, it was not seen as a big deal if you were engaged, betrothed, they called it, and if the woman became pregnant because you were together in her father's house, that was okay. I'm not saying God has an opinion this one way or the other, or that I have an opinion. I'm just saying in the culture, in society, that was seen as okay. In other words, it wasn't the big deal about this is the date of the marriage and this is when the marriage certificate is signed and all that kind of stuff. That's our current culture. That wasn't the culture then. Okay, so let's not put that back on that time. Is that the case during Jesus' lifetime? I don't know. But I have said that, and I gave this in a sermon one time, and I based it on evidence that I had and other things I had read and other things that were historical, that Jesus was likely viewed as an illegitimate child all of his life, and he and Mary were looked down on. And there's evidence, and one of them I'll look at today, there's evidence that was the case. But now I'm going to say, do like Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof. On the other hand, I'm going to give you another side that I wasn't aware of at the time, or would have tempered what I said then. Is it possible that Mary was not discriminated against because of the circumstances of Jesus' birth? In fact, Joseph and Mary were engaged. He took her as a wife, and there may have been no reason to think that Jesus wasn't his kid. Is there evidence for that? Well, yes, there is. Mark chapter 6, verse 3. So I'm correcting my other sermon. I'm not saying I have all the answers, but I just want to... I said it seemed obvious to me that Mary lived under the shadow all of her life, and now I'm not so sure. In fact, I think it's probably likely that she didn't. And I'll give you some reasons for that. Remember, by the way, when in John 2, and I won't turn there, but I spoke about it before. That's when the water was changed to wine in the marriage in Cana. Who commanded the slaves to go get the water pots and do this and that and bring them to Jesus? Mary did. Did they all say, "I'm not listening to you. You've been disgraced"? Somebody else's slaves listened to her. She had some status in the community. In fact, it was important that she was there. And when they ran out of wine, and that was, remember, we talked about how that was such a disgrace. It would be an inhospitable disgrace to that family. Maybe they were related to Mary, maybe they were just good friends, but Mary saw an opportunity to help out by involving her son. But these slaves listened to Mary. She wasn't a persona non grata to them, nor to the family that made sure that she was there and that her family was there at this wedding. Okay? That's evidence number one. Mark chapter 6, verse 3. All right, you're talking about Jesus early on in the ministry, right? Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James and John and Joseph and Judah and Simon? And they were offended because he was just one of them. Why should we listen to him? It doesn't mention Joseph here, maybe because Joseph was dead. I don't know. But it says son of Mary. It does say the carpenter. What does that imply? He had his father's trade. You are what you, as we talked before, what was it like to be a kid in Jesus' day? You did what your father did if you were a boy. Jesus was just viewed as Joseph's son. He's a carpenter like his dad. We can find that other places too. If you're into different versions, there's a papyrus, famous papyrus P45, that has in this, the text here in Greek is, it says son of the carpenter and Mary. Here it says, isn't this, what did I just say? Isn't this the carpenter, the son of Mary? Papyrus 45 has, isn't this the son of the carpenter and Mary? Okay, so maybe it actually right here it's saying he's son of Joseph, that's what was thought. In John 6, I know what you're thinking, but we'll get to that scripture. In John 6, and verse 42, and of course, in John, it's got, you know, totally different slant or different angle of viewing Jesus' ministry. And it goes into long, long discourses that he had with the Jews and so forth. In verse 42, did I say 42? They said, isn't this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How is it that he says, I came down from heaven? So here they're saying, we know his dad. We knew his dad. He's Joseph and Mary's kid. Why should we listen to him? Who is he? So they didn't say, they didn't try to pick on his paternity at this point. And you say, okay, but he does in chapter 8. Let's go to chapter 8 and just look at it. So I think here's some evidence, several scriptures, that seem to indicate that there was no question who his dad was. They didn't question that. And then in John chapter 8, verse 37, you know, Jesus said, I know you're Abraham's seed, because they said, well, you know, they've never been slaves and so forth, which they had, their ancestors had. I know you're Abraham's seed, but you seek to kill me because my word has no place in you. I speak that which I have seen with my father, and you do that which you have seen with your father. All right, so obviously here he's speaking figuratively. He's not saying you're doing what your dad did. He's talking about that he had a different father than they had. And he's talking spiritually, and that's obvious in the context here. We know that. We wouldn't argue that. Verse 39 says, and they answered and said, we have Abraham as our father. And he said, well, if you were Abraham's children, you would do his works, but now you seek to kill me. Verse 41, you do the deeds of your father. They said to him, we're not born of fornication. We have one father, even God. So they're talking figuratively. And I've read this verse before and said, well, look, they knew he was born of fornication, and they were picking on him. Not necessarily. The whole context prior to that doesn't say that. You know, I'm not saying, I can't prove that it's not saying that, but I'm just saying here, the argument is very, you could say, theological or analogical or whatever. They're talking in descriptive terms, not in literal terms here. So, you know, in verse 44, you know, your father, the devil. He's saying that your father's the devil. My father's God. We can take that literally, or we can look at the whole thing figuratively. I think looking at it figuratively is a more accurate way, a more objective way to do it, because that seems to be the way it's written. And then when they said that, they're just saying, look, we're not illegitimate here. We have a pedigree that goes back, and that was important to them because they were, you know, in order to be a priest, you had to prove that you had Aaronic descent. Genealogies were very important at the time of Jesus. It wasn't a hard, very difficult deal to put together Jesus' genealogy because everybody kept their genealogy then. You had to know who was who, so you know who could be the priest and serve in the temple and all that. So I don't think this is talking literally. Yeah, maybe it is, but I don't want to say that anymore. So I would say that the evidence overall leans toward that they just, Jesus was the son of Joseph and Mary. That's what they thought. And that Mary, therefore, did not live her whole life as some kind of an outcast or, you know, that you know, they knew that she had had this child and there's somebody else. I don't think so. I don't think so anymore. So I apologize for the other message, but I gave it with a good heart. I didn't know. And that doesn't mean they didn't pick on Jesus, and you know there are all kinds of issues here where they did, but I don't think it was because of that. And perhaps we were, you know, maybe are, again, putting, maybe I'm putting, and the people, other people I use as resources, putting our 1950s Father Knows Best, happy world type culture back on their culture, which wasn't the same. And as I said, even, you know, several hundred years later, it was okay if you had a child before you had or you became pregnant before you actually had gone through with the wedding supper and all that stuff. It was different. It was just different then. And we don't want to put our current cultures back on that. Okay, I think what I'll do is stop there. The next section I'm going to talk about is very interesting to me. I'll share with you what it would be. It would be about women's work. Okay, what women did. And that might surprise you. It might not. I don't know. Put it this way. I think they did a lot more, and we have evidence right from Scripture. They did a lot more than we might think. And in some ways, it's not as different from today as we might think. In some ways, it is very different, but in some ways, it's not. We'll talk about women's work, and maybe I'll conclude next time. I don't know. We'll start with women's work, and then we'll get into a woman's role in religion. I won't spend much time on a woman's role in pagan religion, but we will explore a little bit of what we know about women in Judaism and what they did and didn't do and where they did it and how they did it and so forth. Some of it's right from the Bible, some of it's other sources. And also, we'll touch on, I think I might get all this. If I don't get it all in one, we'll take two more, but we'll try to get it in one more. I'll touch on a woman's life if she was a slave and how that might compare with what you and I have in our mind as a slave and in what ways it's similar and what ways it's different. I'll just share this little tidbit I was sharing with somebody before service. In Italy, it's estimated that at the time the New Testament was written that 30% of the population were slaves. In the rest of the empire, it's estimated that it was 10%.
Is that indentured servitude?
Not typically. It included indentured servitude. But that was only one of many ways you could end up being a slave. And not, from what I'm reading, not one of the most significant ways. So we'll explore a woman's work. We'll explore a little bit about women in religion. We'll explore the lives of women as slaves. And the fact that just because you were born a slave didn't mean you stayed a slave all of your life. That could change. And it might take one more sermon, might take two. We'll also probably get into certain verses in the New Testament that have to do with women and what the instructions were regarding them. And we may look at those scriptures, not that I'm going to promise you final answers, because some of the things have been debated for 2,000 years and they will continue to be debated, but at least we might be able to look at them with some more background and some more understanding of what life was like on the ground back then, and it may help us to get a more complete understanding of those verses.